This is Bernie Wides, the naturalist. Welcome to Heritage Radio Network, being broadcast from Roberta's Terrific Pizzeria in downtown, Bushwick. And our sponsor is TechServe, which is a terrific place that I patronize also. So my guest today is Carol Butler, who I know from the Museum of Natural History. We're colleagues there. We both work in the Butterfly Conservancy. And Carol has written the whole series of nature books for families. And today she's going to talk about a book that she wrote called Do Bats Drink Blood? And everybody thinks about these bats and terrify them and all that. But we'll try to clear up some of the myths and legends and truths about these fascinating creatures. Bats. So I'd like to introduce Carol Butler to you, and she'll tell us a little bit about herself first, and then we'll get into the subject. We're sure to bite into the subject today.
Oof. Thank you for inviting me, Bernie. Let's see. Well, I did the book on butterflies, and my editor asked me to do two a year since I had such a good time doing it. And so I was thinking about what to write about next, and actually somebody in the Butterfly Conservatory suggested I write about bats. And she said she'd gone on a bat walk in Prospect Park with a fellow named Paul Keim, who does bat walks all over the city in different parks. And so I did that.
Did you see any bats?
No. I found it very disappointing.
Yes, I did the same thing in Central Park.
Right.
Yes.
Did you see bats?
Nope.
No.
And my walk was sponsored by that woman who wrote Central Park in the Dark, Mae Wynn. When she did her reading of the book for the Audubon Society, they set up a thing in Central Park, and we went to the turtle pond and waited for the bats to show up, but they didn't show up. So.
Well, they showed up where we were, but and Paul was very knowledgeable, so I learned a lot about bats. But what we did was we had a couple of echolocators, they hear the echolocations, they pick up the echolocations of the bats, and so they're bat detectors, that's what they're called.
Oh, bat detectors.
So they click, and so you get the clicking, and you say, oh, there's a bat, but you don't see it, you just hear the clicking.
Right.
So we were running around with these bat detectors, trying to see where the bats were flying in the area of Prospect Park where we were. Didn't see anything.
The people must look pretty batty running around with detectors
yeah.
in the park in the middle of the night. So, yes.
All right. But okay. it was very interesting anyway.
Yeah.
And I decided to write about bats, and I started looking around for people who might want to co-author with me. And I contacted Bat Conservation International, which is sort of the premier bat organization in the country. And the person who took my call was Barbara French, who is the science officer there. And she said we'd be interested, and it turned out that she was interested. So she and I wrote it together, which was wonderful. And I actually went, I had never seen a bat.
Mm.
And had no idea how big or small they were or anything. And so Barbara is a bat rehabilitator. And so I went down with my daughter Aisha to Austin, Texas, to actually visit her bats.
Can you tell us what a bat rehabilitator does? Do the bats have like Medicare or something?
Right.
And rehabilitation or what?
Well, Barbara gets phone calls saying, there's a bat stuck in my house.
Okay.
Or I found people call, even in New York it happens, there's a bat in Central Park laying on the ground that appears to be injured. And that's where you try to find a bat rehabilitator who comes and takes the bat and tries to rehabilitate it, tries to bring it back to health and then release it into the wild again.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they can't be released. Barbara has three fruit bats that are from Kenya that were here, brought here from many, many years ago for research, and it's not possible to release them. And so they have their own little house on the side of her house, and it was fantastic. You can really see that they're mammals. She has a mesh netting on the ceiling. And so they came over to us, walking on the netting, coming across the ceiling.
Are they walking upside down?
Upside down, hanging upside down. One of them is very friendly, came right over to Barbara, and she tickled its stomach just like you would pet
really?
A cat. Oh. Yeah. Mm. One was shy and stayed back, and another one, she explained, is very old, and she had a hammock for it. And she said at night, if she didn't put it in the hammock, it would fall to the ground and die. So this bat is being very well taken care of.
That's terrific. I'm glad somebody's taking care of
right.
the bats. I don't know if I'm up for that, but sounds good.
So I actually got to pet a bat, which was quite wonderful. And then on the other side of her house, just to be quick about it, she has micro bats. These are fruit bats, and they're big, relatively big, like a not a squirrel, but like a small rat or something that size, but small, like a small rodent.
Okay,
sounds better.
Are they micro bats and big mega bats?
Right, these were mega bats. Micro bats. The big surprise to me was how tiny they are. Mm. They're very, very small. They weigh just ounces. We have it in the book. We compare them to the weight of coins, because they weigh so little. We were trying to convey how tiny they were, and if you just say ounces, or you know, it doesn't really convey it. So I don't know offhand what it was, but it's very small. The vampire bats, for example, weigh less than 2 ounces each, and that's not by far not the smallest.
Mm-hmm.
So they're really these little tiny things.
So are the vampire bats really like the vampires, like in the legends and all that? Do they suck blood? Do they drink blood? You have a great cover on your book,
right.
And it says, "Do bats drink blood?"
Right.
And fascinating. The book is a fascinating book and really nice.
Thank you.
So can you talk to us about what everybody wants to know about?
That's the first question.
Drinking
right.
blood and vampires and
right.
all that stuff.
Well, most bats don't drink blood. There are about 11,000 species of bats in the world. And they actually are a quarter of all the living mammals are bats, which is interesting. It's in terms of the number of species. The second largest group, the largest group is rodents in terms of mammals. And there are only 3 species that are actually vampire bats. There are false vampire bats, which we have pictures of them in the book, and they thought they were vampire bats, but they're actually carnivorous. So we have a picture of one eating a bird. We have one eating a frog. Some of them eat fish. But vampire bats are very, very small. Two of them, they're the hairy-legged vampire and the white-winged vampire, if you want to know the names, those mainly feed on birds. And we have a wonderful photograph that someone very kindly let us use in the book of a chicken sitting perfectly calmly with a vampire bat under its feathers. You can just see a little foot sticking out. And that's how they feed. The third species does feed on mammals. And what they do is they approach a sleeping animal, and they have pits in their nose that can detect heat, and that's how they find a blood supply. And then they lick the spot very quietly while the animal is sleeping, which softens up the tissue. And when they get it nice and soft, they stick their incisor in, and they have an anticoagulant that flows from their tongue, which keeps the blood flowing, and then they take the blood in on the top of the tongue. So they keep it going. And what's fascinating to me is they only drink a little bit. They drink a couple of tablespoons at most each night. But they will come back to the same spot on the same animal.
How do they find that spot? How do they get back to it? They have other abilities
echolocation? Yeah, they have a lot of senses, echolocation. They have very good vision.
Okay.
The sense of smell is very good.
Mm-hmm.
They've done trials with bats that are fast. I love the name. They call them modified cafeteria trials,
right.
which are wonderful, mm-hmm. where they put out blood from different cows, mm-hmm. and the bats will, they feed them from one type of, from the cat, blood from one particular cow, and they'll come back to that same pool of blood from the smell.
Mm-hmm.
They've also done a trial like that where they had recordings of breathing from different animals. I don't remember if it was animals, it might even be people, but they had the different personalities breathing, and the bats that were fed at the one breathing pattern would go to that breathing pattern rather than the other one, so that they can also hear. There's a lot involved in choosing the spot that they go to.
Yes, I'm trying to picture a bat cafe where you'll go to a takeout table like in our cafeteria.
Well, that's how I picture it, with all the pots of blood.
All the pots of blood, and one is type A, one is type B,
right.
Type C, and then there's, you know, specialized blood. But so what about people? Do they,
that's always the question,
right. Carol.
The idea is that they want to drink blood from a sleeping mammal that's not going to hurt them or chase them away. The only time they'll bother people is if, for example, there's been a herd of cattle in one place for a long time and they're moved away. And the bats come to that place looking for their usual meal and the cattle aren't there. If there's a person who's sleeping in an exposed way where there's no screen or there's no door in the window or someone's sleeping outside, they might drink blood from that person. They'll go to a toe.
Why a toe? You always see pictures of them at the neck of somebody.
Because the blood supply is close to the surface in the toe.
Okay.
And that's the typical place that they'll bite. The story that led to Dracula, which I don't necessarily want to get into, but somebody, an explorer, brought the story to Europe of being bitten by a bat on his toe when he was sleeping outdoors, and that sort of started the legend of how bats will drink your blood if you don't watch out.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, there's very, very little risk of that.
Yeah, I thought that the Red Cross was going to put them on the payroll
for
the blood banks, but I don't think that people would appreciate it. But I always get these visions of blood banks.
Right.
Service, or like a service station for bats. You pull up and you get high test and you get all that.
Right.
So this is a fascinating subject, talking about bats, and we're going to take a little break, and we're going to go out and have a little blood to drink. No, we won't. Maybe sangria is the closest to it. Some sangria, and then we'll be back, Carol Butler and myself, Bernie Wides, and here we are broadcasting from Roberta's Pizzeria, and don't forget our sponsor, TechServe, and we'll be back in a minute. Well, here we are back on the air again. This is Bernie Wides, the naturalist, and today's fascinating topic is about bats. And we're talking to Carol Butler, who has done a beautiful book, a family book on bats, and it's titled Do Bats Drink Blood? And the author is Barbara Schmidt-French and Carol Butler. And Carol is a colleague of mine at the Museum of Natural History, and I know her from the Butterfly Vivarium. And now we're going to get back to this topic of bats. And I've heard something about a disease that's attacking bats called the white nose disease. Is that what it is, Carol?
White nose syndrome.
White nose syndrome. So can you talk about that a little bit, and then we'll get back to the bloody topic.
Okay. White nose syndrome has been in evidence for a couple of years. It was first noticed in New York State, upstate New York. People found bats wandering around, either dead or wandering around in the snow, which they have no business doing because they're supposed to be hibernating in a cave, staying warm. And the bats had a couple of things that were very wrong with them. One was that they didn't have any fat accumulation, which is in any animal that hibernates. They first eat a lot and accumulate fat so they can use that to sustain themselves. And we don't know why, but these bats that are dying don't have the fat accumulation. And the other thing that gives the syndrome its name is that they had some kind of a fungus that was on their nose and on their wings that was a whitish fungus. And scientists have been working very hard to try to figure out the cause of this. They still don't know the cause. The fungus has been identified. It's a cold weather fungus. It survives well in the cold. But we really don't know. It doesn't seem like the fungus is the cause. We don't really know. But there's not been a cause and effect established. It seems that something else is wrong, and then they're vulnerable to the fungus. But it's really everybody's working very hard to try to figure this out. The latest is that this is spreading. Millions of bats have already died in the last couple of years. It's been found in at least 60 hibernation caves in 9 states. It started in the Northeast, but it's as far south as Virginia and West Virginia already. And there's a lot of concern with how it spread. We think that bats spread it, but there's also a possibility that people spread it.
How could that be?
People who are visiting caves or studying caves. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has just issued a voluntary, it's a voluntary restriction on your behavior, asking people not to go into the caves in a state where there have been bats affected with white nose syndrome, just not to do it at all. And if you have a research project or a monitoring project, and so you have a sanctioned reason to go into the cave, they've asked that people have their equipment decontaminated first, mm-hmm. or wear, you know, new clothing, or be very careful not to carry anything into a cave that might have been exposed to the disease in another hibernation cave.
So the question that comes to my mind is, I mean, why do we worry and bother about these critters? They have a very bad reputation. And are they beneficial in any way? They're in the ecosystems, and I know they live in caves, right. And some of them eat fruits, and some of them eat insects. So what purpose, you know, what's their purpose in life besides reproduction?
Right. Well, they're very important. They eat lots of insects. So I always remember somebody who lived in the Caribbean who came into the conservatory and was talking about it, and they said, they heard I was writing a book on bats, and their eyes lit up. They said, we had bats near our house, and it was wonderful because we never had mosquitoes.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah, because they eat hundreds, maybe thousands of mosquitoes a night. So that's one big benefit. The thing they really are valued for, in addition to that, is that they're pollinators, and they pollinate like bees do by getting pollen on their faces and carrying it to the next flower. We have a wonderful cutaway photograph in the book that someone let us use, where you can actually see the bat's nose in the flower, and it's covered with pollen. It's a wonderful shot. But you see that. They have pollen on their noses. And then they also eat fruit, as you said, Bernie. And when they eat fruit, they do a couple of things. One, when they eat small fruit, the seeds pass through them quickly because they have to fly. So their digestive system works quickly. And so in their droppings, they drop the seeds. And the seeds germinate and make new plants. And they like mangoes, the things with big seeds. Mm. And then they drop this. They sit up in the tree, they eat the mango, and then they drop the seed below the tree, and it can start a new plant.
That's good, because I love mangoes. So
I'm allergic to them, so I could do without that part of
they're
it.
They're in the poison ivy family,
right.
Mango. So I'll look at them a little differently now.
Right.
So you started to talk before about false vampire bats and
right.
regular vampire bats. And so what's the difference between a false... I don't know if we... Did we talk about that before?
I just mentioned it briefly.
Yeah.
False vampire bats got that name because they are carnivorous.
Oh, yes,
they
right.
eat animals.
They eat animals, right.
And the vampire bats don't eat animals. They just drink a little blood.
Okay, so... maybe we talk a little bit about all the mythology connected to bats. And one that, I mean, you can start with is the current one, which is the Batman character, cartoon
right.
character.
Right, right, right.
And also, I remember seeing a Broadway show called Bat Boy,
right.
which was a hilarious show.
Right.
And he had a lot of troubles because of his lifestyle.
Right.
So
okay.
I think you have a very nice article in the book on Batman.
Right, that's very sweet of you. That's written by my daughter.
Okay, good.
My editor asked us when we finished the manuscript, one of the Batman movies had come out in that time period, and the editor said, you should really write a sidebar about the Batman movie and about that whole series of movies. And neither Barbara nor I had seen the movie, but my daughter is a big Batman fan, as is my son. So I asked her about it, and she writes beautifully, so I invited her to do a sidebar. And so she researched all of the Batman movies and did a very comprehensive sidebar in the book about Batman. So my daughter I was delighted that she got involved in it, and your daughter also has involved you in this process, right?
That's right. That's how I got into doing these broadcasts.
Right.
My daughter, Erica Wides, who's... Chef Erica, and has a series of programs called Why We Cook. And I'll have to ask if she has any recipes for bat, because I'm sure throughout history people have eaten bats, but
there was a problem. The bat population on some of the islands in the Pacific decreased a great deal because the big bats were considered a delicacy.
Right, the big fruit-eating bats?
Yeah. And people were charging. We have the prices in the book. It was incredible what they were charging for a meal of a bat. And as they became scarcer, the price went up.
Oh, okay. That I can... Okay, so we're going to stop now with that thinking about eating bat. Rather than them eating our blood. And we'll continue in a moment, but we're going to take a break. And remember our sponsor, TechServe, and we are on the Heritage Radio Network. This is Bernie Wides, the naturalist, and my guest, Carol Butler, who is today's bat expert. And we'll be right back.
I love this music.
It's nice. I told them I want to do classical music. Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the naturalist, and we're back on the air. And today's topic, we've been talking about bats. And we've spoken about vampire bats and false vampire bats and fruit-eating bats and my favorite fruit, mangoes. Bats help with that because they help to distribute the seeds. But I've seen photos of bats skimming the surface of the water to get a drink. And Carol, I wonder, I hope they can swim because sometimes they must fall into the water while they're doing this skimming thing. So can you talk about that?
Well, we have, that's one of the questions in the book is, can bats swim because of this habit that they have of, because they need to drink, and they often drink from a pond or even a swimming pool. There's a lot of interesting research about this. We have a photograph of it, of them, of a bat feeding on the top of a pond, so you can actually see how they do it. And they sort of swoop down and drink from the surface and then fly off. And of course, sometimes they do fall in the water if they misjudge. And so the answer is that they can manage in the water. There are fish-eating bats, and they are the ones that have the most facility of swimming and moving around in the water. But other bats, can manage to navigate themselves to the shore if they're not too far away from the shore. But they can't fly from the ground, so they have to go and climb a tree. They have to get some height, and then they drop down, and then they can get enough lift to fly. So they really have to crawl along and crawl up a tree and then drop to fly. And it's why you find bats dead in a swimming pool, because if they fall into a swimming pool, if you think about it, it's much harder. They don't have the slope of the shore, and so they often can't climb out to get it, to be able to fly away. And there's some new research that was just published, very interesting, a guy named Rick Adams in Colorado who's been studying bats for 13 years. And he's been watching these various, a lot of different species of bats in his area. And you have to remember, bats are spending the day in a warm roost in a cave, and they're getting very dehydrated because they're spending a lot of time in this hot, dry place. And so when the sun starts to go down and it becomes dusk, they really need to have a drink. They can be as much as 30% dehydrated. Mm. And if they're lactating, if they're nursing mothers, it's even more of a problem. So they want to have a drink. But what he found that's fascinating to me is they don't all converge on the local watering hole. They come at each species or group comes at certain times from maybe a colony group or a species in general. They come at certain times, and it's a predictable time over from night to night and from year to year. So you can set your clock by the small brown bats are coming at this time.
They come for sort of cocktail hour.
They come for cocktail hour, right. And they don't all just plunge in. They line up like jets on a runway. This, I think, is to avoid bumping into each other so they don't get knocked into the water. So they come one after another on the same path, which is just incredible, and have their drink and go off, and then the next group comes.
Like an aircraft carrier.
Exactly.
Terrific.
Right.
Okay, so let's get back to this, some of the fears of bats. Like people say they're going to fly into your hair.
Right.
Can you talk about that? I think you mentioned how they navigate in the dark, the echolocation.
Right.
But they must be very good at that.
They are.
And do they all do it? Do all bats do echolocation? Or?
Not all of them. Some of them echolocate. They all have good vision. And some of them, they have very good spatial memory, which is sort of making a cognitive map of where they're going. They can remember the roads, signposts, the features of the landscape that are familiar to them. So they use different species have different combinations, but they use different combinations of echolocation and spatial memory and vision and smell to find what they're looking for. Echolocation is interesting. They breathe in on the downstroke and out on the upstroke. Am I getting it right? Let's see.
Of their wings.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So they put the echolocation pulse out on the upstroke. So that if you think of, I'm moving my arms like a bat, but if you think about it, when you're exhaling, that's when they give out the echolocation pulse as the wings go up.
Okay, and the echolocation actually is sound.
It's the sound.
And some of it we can't hear.
Right. It can be it's a high-pitched sound.
Yeah.
They make a lot of sounds. When I was in Texas, I was under the bridge in Austin where there's a huge colony of bats, and they make a racket. And Barbara has studied the sounds and can understand certain sounds mean different things.
So they communicate with each other too, by sound.
Right.
Yeah.
The echolocation pulses are only effective a relatively short distance, maybe 20 yards, which is not that short, but it's a limited distance. So they have to get close to the area where they're finding something to eat, where the feed is interesting to them, and then they echolocate to narrow down the target.
The target, right. And they eat, you said they eat a lot of insects.
Right.
So I know that they eat moths also,
and
butterflies and all that.
Right.
And I've read, probably in your book, about how their prey tries to avoid being eaten by these radar carrying bats.
Right.
So they have countermeasures to confuse the bats.
Right.
It's just like our fighter planes.
Right.
Some of the fighter planes will release metal chaff, pieces of metal, to deflect the enemy's radar. So these insects do similar countermeasures?
Right.
Kind of thing?
The moths give off sounds that confuse the echolocation, and toxic moths make a certain sound that bats learn to avoid for the same reason as the toxic butterflies. So they do try to defend against them. Some of the moths try to defend against them, but bats have to eat, so.
Right. It's a constant evolutionary thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You were asking about bats flying into people's hair, which is one of the common fears that people have. One of the thoughts is that if you're in the country, bats are attracted to insects, and so they swoop down to get the insects, and people are fearful that they're swooping down towards them. So that it's really the proximity rather than that they're actually going after the people. The root of it, I think, is in the New Testament, Paul proclaims that women should cover their head in church to protect them from dangerous spirits. And these spirits supposedly had demonic powers that were attracted to unbound female hair.
Oh, okay.
So having your hair uncovered was dangerous, and you could attract evil spirits, demons. And bats get confused with demons because they're nocturnal and they're mysterious, and so they have spawned a lot of legends and myths in all different cultures.
Sure, you see some on the sides of some churches and all that, some of the sculptures, like the gargoyles and stuff like that. Some of them are bats, I think, and I've seen images of bats there. So bats have a bad reputation. So
in some places where bats are diurnal, where they fly during the day.
Daytime flying bats, yeah.
They have a good reputation because they don't have all that mystique. And people know that they eat bugs and that they're pollinators and they're
useful.
Not a problem.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, are they one of the few flying mammals, bats? And you know, they don't have wings like birds, right? They have sort of membranes between their fingers. And there are some other flying mammals that glide a lot, but I don't know if there are other ones
bats. There's a flying squirrel. There's a wonderful Cherokee fable about the origin of bats. I'll try to make it short. There are two small mouse-like creatures wanted to participate in a ball game in which the birds challenged the animals. Because the bats had 4 feet, they were asked if they could play with the animals, and the larger animals made fun of them because they were so small and chased them away. Then they asked if they could play with the birds, and the birds took pity on them and made wings out of the skin of a drum. So they stretched the leftover pieces of skin between the forelimbs and made wings on the one of them, and on the other one they put the skin at the hind legs, between the hind legs, making it a flying squirrel.
Okay.
So that's the origin of the two flying creatures, at least in terms of that Cherokee mythology.
Good. Yeah. Okay, so and we should also stress that they're really mammals.
Yes.
You know, and because people look at them as just rodents. Well, some rodents are mammals also. So to be a mammal, you have to have some kind of hair or fur.
Right.
And the females have to nurse their babies.
Right.
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 And they have to have
live birth.
Live birth, and also be endothermic, produce heat. So I think bats fit in nicely there. And this has been a really good talk. There's so much more we can talk about. But you'll just have to buy Carol's book.
You'll have to buy the book. And we have a lot of legends in the book, which you'll enjoy.
All the good legends are in the book. And the book is available at the museum bookstore, online
right.
at Amazon and places
Barnes & Noble,
like Barnes & Noble. It's widely distributed. And while you're looking at the Bat book in the bookstore, look at all of Carol's other books. And I think we're going to sign off today because it's time for lunch, and I don't know if we're going to have any. red wine might be good after this.
I agree.
It's a little sanguine thing, which means red, which means blood. And we'll be on again another day with some more interesting naturalist facts and things. So I hope you enjoyed the show, and thank you, Carol, for coming.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And sign off for the Heritage Radio Network, our sponsor TechServe, and Roberta's Pizzeria, which we're looking forward to having some pizza for lunch now.